Hello, this is Dr. Michael Ash, and today we'll be mapping short-chain fatty acids on the 15-minute matrix.
Welcome to the 15-minute matrix. I'm Andrea Nakayama, functional medicine nutritionist and your host. This is the podcast that brings you bite-sized insights and lessons on how to use the most important tool in functional medicine and functional nutrition. Today on the 15-Minute Matrix, you are in for a real treat as I'll be speaking with Dr. Michael Ash. Michael is an osteopath, naturopath, and nutritional therapist qualified for over 30 years. Michael has been involved in researching and developing strategies for the resolution of mucosal immune-mediated inflammatory and oxidative events that contribute to the genesis and prolongation or development of chronic ill health. He has specialized in the role of the wet tissues in the body with an emphasis on the gut and nutrition-related events. These days, he primarily spends time developing educational programs for medical practitioners seeking to learn to apply lifestyle and functional medicine in their clinical lives. We have so much to cover that I'm going to dive right in. Dr. Ash, a big welcome to you. One of the reasons I so appreciate your work is that you have a unique way of illuminating the complex interactions between diet, lifestyle, the microbial makeup, the mucosal barrier, and immunity. You basically speak in the matrix all the time. So in our 15 minutes together or so, I thought we could tease apart the connections between the short chain fatty acids, the health of the GI, and anything else that comes to mind for you. So with that in mind, where would you start this story? Does it start in the gut, or should we first be looking at antecedents and triggers to explain these connections?
Short chain fatty acids are the byproduct of the fermentation by the organisms, predominantly the bacteria present in your colon, and the food selection that they're given, preferably a form of starch that is resistant to being broken down in the small intestine. So it arrives in adequate quantities in the colon to give them a decent dinner. And the consequences of that is the production of a series of acidic byproducts, which we call short-chain fatty acids. And there are three principal short-chain fatty acids, but the one that dominates most people's consciousness if they are interested in exploring this area is butyrate.
Right.
And so the short-chain fatty acid story has waxed and waned a little bit over the last 20 years. And where I find the story these days is that it runs alongside the sort of cornerstone of metabolic nutritional intervention, which is that we, by which I don't mean you and me, of course, but we as in the Western society have disavowed ourselves of the benefit of fibrous foods. We've moved much more towards a refined or finished food product. Mm-hmm. And so we only consume about 12 grams on average per person, which is approximately 10% of our nearest existing hunter-gatherer population, the Hadza, who consume between 100 and 120 grams per day. Now, that's an enormous amount.
Yes.
And for most Western people, that seems almost impossible. But the consequence of that is that the table is far less laden with enjoyable treats for the bacteria. And the consequence is that their metabolic message, the components that our immune system and the epithelial cells, that's the cells that line the colon and the small intestine, who are codependent on access to short-chain fatty acids, and I'm obviously focusing on butyrate at the moment, but they're codependent upon it for a variety of quite sophisticated interactions. And butyrate has an affinity for a specialized set of receptors called G-protein coupled receptors. And don't worry about remembering that name, but drug targets look for these specialized receptors when scientists are trying to develop a drug to block or to impede a certain amount of activity. Well, butyrate binds to two of its very own specialized receptors. You know, we've developed these over the hundreds of thousands of years we've been eating fiber. And they bind to these receptors and they confer a series of signals that favor an anti-inflammatory or immune-mediating set of responses. So the cascade is your eyes and your nose should be the first point of contact with your decision-making. You should have an organoleptic associated experience together with some sort of rational behavior, which means you choose a fibrous food. That fibrous food should eventually make its way to the colonies of organisms present in the colon, where they settle down for an evening's chomp. Mm-hmm. And the consequences from that are that they should disperse amongst their immediate colleagues and our tissues and our blood, this combination of short-chain fatty acids, for which butyrate is the most abundant and clinically the most useful, because it can also cross the blood-brain barrier. So we can consume a fiber and then mediate a response in the brain through the transfer of a short-chain fatty acid, which struck me as being quite fascinating a few years ago when I also began to uncover the role of butyrate in repairing damage to neural tissues in the brain. Mm-hmm. It helps to reprogram tissues that have become damaged. It helps to reduce inflammation. And consequently, I think you know this as well as most of your listeners, that there is a very strong association between changes in mood or affect,
right,
and the presence of inflammatory or certain types of small molecular molecules called cytokines that disturb people's consciousness or their sense of joy or their sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. And if we look at your matrix, where we have a whole range of intersecting events that compound either individually, but most commonly as a combination of at least two or three events, one of the most common symptomologies that people present with is a lack of joy or happiness in their lives, and a sense of disconnect or disorganization in terms of their thought processes. And so we looked many years ago now at the role of improving people's gross food intake to include higher levels of short chain or fatty acid producing foods to facilitate a reduction in the burden of inflammation, not just in the brain to improve mood, but also to improve other tissues that may also be affected from the liver, the heart and joints, etc. So the nub, if you like, of why do short chain fatty acids present for us a useful tool is that they're entirely consistent with that choice that you're asking people to make in the first place.
So, right. To make a dietary change at all is going to take some of that inspiration and that, you know, dopamine change of seeing possibility and hope in the future.
Running alongside that concept where we're looking at how do we shift somebody towards a food selection that favors a choice of fibers, which in turn ultimately produce an outcome in them, which we are trusting by virtue of the understanding of the mechanisms here, are going to reduce their ill health or their adverse health events and favor a greater promotion of health generation. One of the consequences of getting people to make that change can't simply be people like you and me having a very, what should we say, not didactic so much, but an instructional conversation where we're just setting up the list of things that someone should do on the basis that we believe it's going to make them feel better. On your antecedents, triggers, and mediators, that's a story.
Right.
What we're looking at there is a history of somebody's experiences. It's an experiential journey as to why they've ended up with you or your listeners needing to engage in some of the changes associated in the central part.
Right.
And so I think that, and I'm sure you've covered this, but I think one of the great tools that we have is through the communication of repetition, which is that once we've heard that person's history, their journey, if you like, as to why they're there in front of you on that particular day and why they're asking you for help, it isn't enough to assume that they're going to take that away unless we frame it in such a way that it makes a coherent, emotive, and contractual outcome for them.
Exactly.
And I don't mean we have to write a 16-page document about why they're not going to leave the room unless they promise to eat 15 grams of high-quality fiber every day. But to connect with somebody.
Connection. It's the connecting of their why. Why are they here? Why does this matter to them? And why is there a problem that they're experiencing with what they have to do?
Absolutely. So I and this is something not unfamiliar, but phrasing their experience back to them through a story, a narrative that rewrites their history in your language, but within a time frame that brings them up to today, is terrifically powerful. It keys people up, and I think, but on its own, it's not enough. But I think it's a great way of starting to present, here you are, this is what I've heard about you, this is where we are today. And then you need to frame the recommendations. And obviously, we've looked at short-chain fatty acid and fiber for the first point, but we need to give them some sort of clear objectives that they can agree to, that they can often make a recommendation themselves. So what would you like to improve the most? So you kind of identify a path for them. And then you've got to try and take that story and tease out from that story things that you can use your expertise to see what they would choose to hang that commitment on. Right. Is it for an event? Is it for their own career progression? Is it for a family member that's desperately worried about them? You've got to find something that ties them in emotionally to that commitment, because changing people's behavior is the hardest thing in the world, and you've got to try and make it as easy for them as it is for yourself.
So Dr. Ash, related to the story and looking at the antecedents in particular, are we seeing a shift in butyrate and other short-chain fatty acids over time, over generations?
Do you mean that as each generation now appears to be carrying a lower range of diversity in the bacterial composition of their gut, does that have a translational consequence in the production of short-chain fatty acids?
Exactly, as well as our reduction in the intake of fiber over time. If we were to look at the progressive reduction of fiber intake, are we seeing that affect levels of short-chain fatty acids and therefore affect the whole soup, the whole central area of the matrix even more?
We have an extensional or an extendable conversation around that point. If the range of organisms in which the production of butyrate or acetate or propionate are being denuded through a loss of transmission because of changes in both birthing techniques and a long history of exposure to medications or lack of stimulation, so that we see a lower level of diversity, and then we don't nourish them with the appropriate right of food, you're compounding that same story. So you are providing a absence of appropriate dialogue. You're not providing the words effectively found in the fiber that a story can be generated by the rereading of that fiber by the organisms. And I think it's quite difficult when we're often looking, you know, over 30 to 60 years to see whether that's going to translate into a propensity for more inflammation-driven diseases. But if we take the very broad view here, in which we have the keystone element, which is an absence of fiber, followed by the workers also being absent, then clearly, if this is a causal component of non-communicable disease, which dominates all of our healthcare work these days, then unfortunately, each generation appears to be predisposing themselves by inheritance and by choice, to make it much harder to produce these anti-inflammatory molecules.
Interesting to think about how this is progressively getting worse on every level. What we're seeing is GI integrity compromised, therefore the immunity compromised. Also, I know you make connections that you might want to speak into about the mitochondrial barrier integrity, but also in that mind, spirit, emotion arena where we're able to make changes for ourselves and have that hope and that insight and that reality that we can change our lives. So it's impacting generation after generation.
One of the big questions that is seen much more in conservative gastroenterology meetings these days is, if dysbiosis, which is a disordered relationship between you and whatever organisms you happen to have inherited or acquired, exists in the gut, is there a perfect relationship? You know, what do we need to give someone to change that? And is it a consequence of something that that person has done, or is it a driver, causal element for why they are where they are now? And those aren't always easy to answer. But what is clear is that the low-grade level of inflammation that exists normally in a healthy human gut at the barrier for reasons of priming certain types of immune cells gets altered. And you've just sort of touched on one point there, which is that the barrier itself is highly dynamic. It's tightly controlled, but it's not a static barrier. It's changing all the time. And it has one made up of mucins or mucus and one made up of the physical intersection of epithelial cells. And butyrate or short-chain fatty acids are utilized by an energy-generating historical bacteria, which is our mitochondria. And an absence of butyrate also leads to a reduction in the level of mucins. Yeah. And so short-chain fatty acids then mean that bacteria that shouldn't touch the epithelial barrier sometimes do. And the consequence of that is the induction of a defensive mechanism, which actually damages mitochondria in the epithelial tissues, so they produce more oxidative stress. And whilst that's a signaling molecule, a low level to maintain flux, that's the ability to open and close, if it becomes too much of a stimulus, the opposite happens and the barrier becomes over-permeabilized. And ironically, one of the things or some of the things that tend to damage these mitochondria are the same things that damage us. So toxins or stress and drugs, etc., all things that can lead to a change in our gut barrier function, also change our mitochondrial function. And we had this glorious intersection where the energy-generating components of our epithelial cells, for which those transcellular and paracellular junctions are codependent, start to manifest a response to our environmental cues, not just within the gastrointestinal tract, but also those within our environment. Mm-hmm. And it's intrigued me that whilst this very energy-dependent process is understood when it goes wrong, one of the things that we need to look at clinically is whether or not we can restore some form of mitochondrial competence, reduce the appropriate or inappropriate induction of oxidative stress, and at the same time, as we've been chatting about, change the production of the short-chain fatty acids, which should provide fuel for these epithelial cells and their mitochondria. So we have this beautiful, if you like, intersection between choice, and choice about what we eat is often driven by mood, and mood is also driven by the induction of inflammatory cytokines inside the gastrointestinal tract and elsewhere. And breaking that cycle is part of the skill set that most of your students, colleagues, and professional practitioners that are involved in this area are looking to do through the utilization of your matrix. And where they start is often what they learn through that narrative. But if we leave today's conversation or conclude, if you like, a story we have here is that we have, by circumstance, become less efficient at managing the conversion of fiber. By choice, we consume less of it. And a consequence of that is that we see a reduction in our resilience and our stress, change in our relationships, often a reduction in exercise and movement, and alterations in our sleep patterns, all of which can be mediated through appropriate nutritional choices and change. So knowing it doesn't make a difference unless someone changes.
Exactly. And, you know, I can't let you go without asking some of your favorite tactics for changing the production of short-chain fatty acids. And I just want to underscore what you're saying, because I always say that the psychology doesn't exist without the physiology. And that's exactly what you're talking about here, that the mood, the behavior, the habit change, it all exists because of some of these reductions in the short-chain fatty acids and also the lack of diversity in the microbial terrain. So when we're talking about changes in the production of short-chain fatty acids, where does food come in and what kinds of fibers?
I'll give you a couple of nice, simple takeaway choices in a minute. But I guess what I've many years ago, I did a degree in economics. So I tend to think economics and politics about how to translate some of this information. We have people that come and see us that are primarily driven by habit towards hedonistic choices, that is short-term satisfaction. And to get them to shift that towards a more sort of pension contribution thought process for long-term investment, we've got to provide them a series of stepping stones. So I try and find foods that facilitate a shift that isn't so dramatic, but someone will reject the proposal, is tasty enough that they'll repeat it, and but at the same time confers an advantage far more than they might imagine. So you've heard me say this before, but the stewed apples, or applesauce as it's known in the US, is effectively where you take a cooking apple, peel it, and then cook it down with some cinnamon until it makes a moderately gloopy but pleasant looking dessert, to which you can then add additional components such as either probiotics or some other forms of powdered carriers into that, so you can deliver it to people who are fussy eaters. And let me just say that most men are useless at changing their behaviors, but most of them quite like a stewed apple. And then you can have a natural yogurt on that to provide some extra bacteria. Now that has quite a sophisticated series of interventions inside the gastrointestinal tract, and generally speaking, if you take six large cooking apples, that should last an individual 3 days, 3 to 4 days dosage wise and if you do that for between 2 and 3 weeks, you can see a significant change in somebody's ecology based on stool samples and also some gastrointestinal sampling that favors organisms that generate anti-inflammatory mechanisms. And the takeaway from there is it's not one apple a day that keeps the doctor away. In this case, it works out to be two. And so that's the first pitch for you. And the second thing is that the Greeks long ago realized that chickpeas, which you can turn into hummus for ease of eating, and olives also conferred variety of nutritional benefits to the consumer. And again, what we've learned over the time is raffinose, which is the primary fiber found in chickpeas, favors the induction of a particular immune cell called a regulatory T cell through a variety of complicated triggering mechanisms, which favors an anti-inflammatory process and calms down cytokines. So if you were trying to think beyond bananas and cold potatoes and other types of resistant starch and wanted to be a little bit more imaginative, then my stewed apples or cooking apples, olives, preferably green or black olives, which are of a reasonable size, 4 or 5 a day of those, and some chickpeas consumed as hummus over a period of time will change bacterial composition and induce the production of short-chain fatty acids.
Brilliant. I love it. I can talk to you all day long, but I won't take any more of your time. Dr. Ash, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
The 15-Minute Matrix is brought to you by me, Andrea Nakayama, and the Functional Nutrition Alliance. The 15-Minute Matrix team includes my son, Gilbert Nakayama, on sound production, Renee Hunt, Natalie Merrill, and Christine Shook. You can visit us and hear more episodes at 15minutematrix.com. And if you'd like to be notified each time there's a new podcast episode ready and waiting for you, please go to 15minutematrix.com/notify. We will be sure to drop into your inbox with a short reminder that a new episode is ready and waiting for you. Plus, you always have an open invitation to email us. I definitely want to know who you'd like to hear on the podcast and what topics you'd like seen mapped on the 15-Minute Matrix. You can email us anytime at ask@15minutematrix.com. That's ask@15minutematrix.com. I don't know about you, but I'm off to make some stewed apples.